Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5 over North America and worldwide on the Internet 7 days a week. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay with us for tonight's special report on the national debt right after this message. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper like stocks, bonds, and Federal Reserve notes. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin or clad coin and currency. And you know that's true. When we deal with banks, government, and commercial industries, there's no difference. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a real difference. 7-to-1 is the difference in purchasing power, and 7-to-1 is the difference in the taxes that are due on that paper money over the gold and silver money. You know, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us if we were to deal in and to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver away from us for no good reason either. Because they knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away their gold and silver coin in order to take away the people's right to property and to destroy their property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we've got to first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. Now, let me teach you how to do just that. This business school is now a compact disc for adult homeschoolers. And for more information about my private business school, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free of charge. And you can call right now to order yours, the number 417-273-4967. And my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Last time we were talking about Edward Gibbons, who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And I said that there's five major causes for the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Let's pick it up right there. Money, number one. Religion, number two. Taxes, number three. Morals, number four. And then crime and corruption. And we have one of the most corrupt governments that the world has ever seen. Today in America, we openly bribe our politicians. We call it campaign contributions. We call it soft money, hard money, campaign contributions, lobbying. You know, just hang a label on it, whatever turns you on, whatever makes you feel good. But the bottom line is, it's bribery. When institutions like the pharmaceutical industry, the meat industry, Tyson, ADM, Cargill, you name it, are passing out millions of dollars, like Enron, millions of dollars to the Bush campaign, those are campaign bribes, pure and simple, for favorable legislation to be enacted by congressmen and the president for those industries and those companies. Look at Halliburton. They received a no competition bid in Iraq. They just hired him and said, here, send us a bill. Here's a blank check. Fill in the amount. And the taxpayers pay it. That's the kind of corruption that destroyed the Roman Empire, and I predict it will destroy the United States of America. The five causes, that is, the debasing of the money, the debasing of religion, the excessive taxes, the decline in morals, and the crime and corruption that developed in the Roman Empire has destroyed that empire, and it will destroy the United States. These are the five symptoms, five causes that have destroyed every empire and every civilization from day one. And the average length, now remember, is about 200 years for a civilization or empire. The United States is about 225 years old. Hitler's Third Reich, 13. The Roman Empire, 400. You know, we've reached our average, and we are corrupt. Now, we're talking about our national debt, and it isn't just the national debt at the federal level. George Bush, by the way, has added 26% to the federal budget, or the federal, I should say, the federal national debt since he took office. In George Bush's first term, he ran up the debt by an additional 25%. Now, that's real spending, more than $1.5 trillion. But, you know, boys and girls, that's just the tip of the iceberg, the tip of the iceberg. The big debt that's out there is $150 trillion in derivatives. Boy, now that one's our Achilles heel. Then we've got all of the mortgages on our houses in America, plus we've got all of the credit card debt. You know, if you took all of our debts, the national debt, all of the state government debts, all of the city government debts and county government debts, all of the mortgage debt, credit card debt, and derivatives debt, and you add all that up, and we're talking about some real money. I mean, we're talking about at least $200 to $250 trillion. And that's just the United States of America. The whole world is living on a great big debt bubble. And this debt bubble is going to implode one of these days. And when it does, it'll take all the world's economies just like it did back in the 1920s. Now, that doesn't mean the world comes to an end. It just means that there's going to be a massive transfer in wealth. For instance, if you're in debt, let's suppose you have $100,000 worth of equity in your $200,000 home, and you owe $100,000, you can't service that debt, you're going to lose your home. That doesn't mean your home gets burned to the ground or disappears. Somebody else is going to take over your home. You're going to move out, somebody else is going to take it. And then they're going to come up with some kind of a plan to sell it. And then the government will come up with some kind of new money, whether it's gold-backed or silver-backed or fiat currency. They'll just change the color of it and start over again. Everybody gets wiped out. That's what happened in Germany back in 1923. After it inflated up to trillions of marks to buy a loaf of bread, well, then they threw that money away and started with some new money. But, of course, everybody lost everything they had. You lose your cars, you lose your toys. And then out of that, you start over again. See how simple that is? And all you old folks that are out there, like me, I'm one of the old folks, we have to start over again at age 65, 70, 75, or 80. That's all. Unless you take some kind of action today, I mean, you know, you could prepare for this ahead of time. It's a wild new concept, of course, but the Federal Reserve pays the cost of printing to the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, and let's say they got $1 billion, perhaps as little as $500, doesn't make any difference. They pay $500 to print up $1 billion worth of currency to make this kind of an exchange. They just create this money right out of thin air, and the government then uses the money to pay its bills. What are the results of this fantastic transaction? Well, the government's bills are paid all right, and the U.S. government has now indebted the people to the Federal Reserve bankers for that $1 billion plus interest. The Federal Reserve creates the $1 billion out of thin air. The government spends that money into circulation, inflates the currency, and then you and I have to pay the billion plus the interest on it. Isn't that just real special? It's bad enough that they make us pay the interest on it, but we've got to pay the principal too. And that's because there was no principal there. You see, gold money, the way God designed the program, gold money comes out of the ground by labor. The Federal Reserve has a franchise that was granted to them, and they can create $1 billion right out of thin air and make you pay it. Isn't that just special? Now, since this and similar transactions have been going on since 1913, now, around 70 years later or so, the government is indebted to the bankers for $7 trillion, and it's going to be about $8.5 trillion by the end of this fiscal year, on which the people are taxed over, well, it says $6 billion here. That's 1977. Last time I worked this out, it was in the neighborhood of $350 billion a year. Let me divide, that's probably up around 400 now. Let me just take 400 and divide that by 12 and see how much that is a month. That's about $33 billion a month is what we're paying in interest. Not that that means anything to anybody because the numbers are so big. You know, like trillions and trillions of dollars and billions and billions and millions and millions and, you know, pretty soon it's so far out of touch with reality we can't grasp it. It's, suffice it to say, more money than you can pay off. So what are we going to do? Well, those that are in debt are going to lose everything that they're indebted for. Credit cards, houses, big screen TVs, automobile, all your toys. And, of course, your businesses and inventory. And, you know, some of you people you know may have a balance sheet. I remember I used to carry a balance sheet with my bank, the Bank of Idaho. I'd show something on there. Well, my net worth is $550,000. And then I'd put on there, well, my total obligations are $250,000. My net worth then is about $250,000, $300,000. And we all do that. And we see ourselves as being pretty wealthy people. You know, I mean, after all, you know, if you own a house and it's worth $200,000 and you only owe $50,000 on it, you see yourself as being worth $150,000. That's a fiction. That's a dream. That's a non sequitur. That isn't true. The bank owns your house. You have an equitable interest in the bank's house. And if you can specifically perform on the terms of the contract, which you won't be able to do, then you lose the house. So the best thing you can do is to sell the house today. That is, pass the old maid on to somebody else. Somebody else is going to lose. Somebody is going to lose his shirt. In fact, most of the people in the nation are going to lose their shirt because right now, if you take all the money and you cash it in, you can only get 2% of it in goods. If you take all the houses that are for sale, all the goods on Walmart shelves, all the goods and services that are available out there, 2% is all you can get. All the rest of it is just inflated trash. Now, if a few people go out and collect off of that 2% that's available, they can, of course, collect 100% of everything that they've got in some form of hard goods. And there's more. It gets better than this. You say, this is terrible? Well, yeah, that's pretty bad, all right, but we've only shown you a part of the sordid story under the debt money system. Those United States bonds referred to above have now become assets of the banks in the system against which they can now make loans to individual and commercial customers. Since the U.S. banking laws require only a 10% reserve, this means that the bankers can lend up to 10 times the amount of the bonds that they have on hand. On the one transaction of $1 billion that we just discussed, they can lend $10 billion to private customers in interest. This gives them upwards of $10 billion out of interest for the original cost of them of as little as $500. And since Congress no longer creates the issues or and issues the money under the Constitution, the only way our people can get our businesses and our houses and our money to carry on trade and expand farming and industry is to borrow it from the bankers. So all of our money is borrowed into circulation. So when you see Halliburton being paid outrageous amounts of money for not doing work, what's going on here is the government is inflating the currency now by $4 trillion. They've got to get this money out into circulation. And they need to run a war. See, wars are wonderful for expanding money because wars are destructive and there's nobody to watch where all the money's being spent. You can't keep track of all the money that's being spent. And it goes to Halliburton, and then it goes to all the companies that are contracting, and Halliburton hires a bunch of people, and this is what brings prosperity. It's actually just a myth, but it makes everybody feel good because we're all out here earning money. Jobs are going to be created now. I mean, there's jobs coming, and there's all this money in circulation, and God, everybody's euphoric. And this goes on for 2 or 3 years, and then, of course, reality comes back again. Now, there was a time when we Americans had a sound economy. That is, we had a production economy rather than a consumer economy. Today, 67% of our gross domestic product is consumption. Well, consumption's a lot of fun, and everybody likes to consume, but somebody has to produce. And right now, you've got all those Chinese working for 14 cents an hour producing for you. And they're working hard. And they're saving their money. And someday, they want you to send them a computer, an automobile, or a Caterpillar tractor. And if they present too many of those bills due, those notes for payment, you can't pay. You become insolvent. It's kind of like trying to make your payments, you know, on your credit card at the end of the month, you've got enough money to go around. Well, when the United States defaults, boy, that's going to send shivers around the world. Now, see, so far we haven't defaulted. So far we've been making our payments. And the way we're making our payments, of course, right now, is by inflating the currency. Now, of course, that isn't too good. You see, the Chinese were working for us back in 1990, 91, 92, 93, 94. So they'd go out and they'd work 8 hours and they would get paid 14 cents an hour. How much is it? 14 times 8. See how much those Chinese are making. My God, they're making $1.12 a day. That's about what my granddad was making back in 1900, $1 a day. And they're saving about 25% of that in China, and they're reinvesting it over there like crazy. And they worked that day for $1.12. Well, now, if we inflate our currency over here by 25%, well, then they're going to lose times 0.25, 28 cents worth of purchasing power off of that, aren't they? So they work for $1.12, but they're only going to get paid, you know, about 78 cents of that, round numbers, 80 cents. Hey, I don't think they're going to be too happy about that. You wouldn't be too happy, would you? No, I wouldn't be very happy. So when the Chinese and the Japanese and the Malaysians, the Filipinos and others start putting in these claim checks and says, okay, well, we'd like to buy some stuff now. Gosh, we'd like to have an automobile. You know, gosh, we'd like to have a big screen TV. And you get too many people out there making too many claims. It's like having a bank, you know, with not enough money and too many people making withdrawals. You know, you get a run on the bank. So far that hasn't happened. And of course, our government's doing everything they can. You can trust me. George Bush is working his heart out trying to stave off world collapse of the economy. And I'm sure that all the Alan Greenspans in the world and all the central bankers are out there just working at the G7 meetings, just doing everything they can to stave this off. But there's an inevitable day of reckoning that's coming. We thought it was going to come 30 years ago. It didn't. So, and it's a bigger, better bubble today than it was 30 years ago. And it'll be a lot longer on the upside coming out. You know, the last big depression we had in the world was 1929 to 39, about 10 years. And this one here, you know, is going to be quite a little story, too. You know, I'm not a prophet. I don't know if it's going to take 10 years to get over it or 3 years or whatever. The big thing to be concerned about is the big transition, the big shift in ownership of the property. Today, you own the house. Who's going to own it next year? Now, of course, there are some people that will be selling their houses, putting their money in gold, sticking it in a hole in the ground, and waiting for the collapse to come. Then they'll come back and buy their house for $10,000 of the new money, whatever the new money is. Gold holds its value. It has for 5,000 years. My guess is it will probably for the next 10 or 15. Hey, but there's still more. If you think this is bad so far, listen to this. In addition to the vast wealth drawn to them through this unlimited usury, the bankers who control the money at the top are able to approve or disapprove large loans to large and successful corporations. To the extent their refusal of a loan will bring about a reduction in the price of that corporation's stock sells for in the marketplace. So after depressing the price, the banker's agents then buy large blocks of the stock, after which the sometimes multi-million dollar loan is approved. Then the stock rises and is then sold for profit. In this manner, billions of dollars are made with which to buy more stock. This practice is so refined today that the Federal Reserve Board need only announce to the newspapers an increase or decrease in their rediscount rate to send stocks up and down as they wish. Using this method since 1913, the bankers and their agents have purchased secret or open control of almost every large corporation in America. In fact, they've done it worldwide. The big banking institutions are now in control or ownership of nearly everything in the world. Using that control, they then force the corporations to borrow huge sums of money from their banks so the corporations' earnings are siphoned off in the form of interest to the banks. This leaves very little as actual profits, which can be paid as dividends, and explains why stock prices are so depressed. And while the banks reap billions in interest from corporate loans, in effect, the bankers get almost all the profits while individual stockholders are left holding the bag. The millions of working families of America are now indebted to the few thousand banking families for more than the assessed value of the entire United States with all its assets. And these banking families obtained this debt against us for the cost of paper and ink and bookkeeping entries. They never paid anything for it. Now, the people of America, though, are the proximate cause of their own injury. See, because God told us, thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. And we said, oh, no, we're going to have paper money and stocks and bonds and go out in the marketplace and get rich. We're going to speculate in real estate. God said the land shall not be sold forever. And he said, oh, that's no good. We're going to have real estate brokers, real estate agents, real estate companies. We're going to buy and sell land. We're going to make a killing. Okay, but boys and girls, there's no such thing as a broken law without a penalty. Now, we've been told, don't do that. And we said, kiss off. We're going to do it. Well, okay. You got to go to 1 Samuel chapter 8. It's a pretty illuminating chapter. You see, the people came to Samuel and they said, hey, Samuel, we want a king like all the nations around us. Samuel was bummed out, so he went to God and he said, hey, God, the people are rebelling. They want a king. And God said, well, give them a king. Why would we want to get in the way of their happiness and success? He said, but listen, let me tell you what the problem is. They're not rebelling against you, Samuel. They're rebelling against me. The people hate me. They hate God. That's a problem with you people out there. You all hate God. How do I know that? Well, Romans 8, verse 7 tells us, the carnal mind is enmity against God, isn't subject to the law of God, and neither indeed can be. All right, so now that's a given. You don't like God, and you don't like his law. So you went out and you broke the law. This is your opportunity to learn from the school of hard knocks. As my old daddy used to tell me, he said, son, the best way to learn is from experience. There's nothing like it. But he said, it's a god-awful hard way to learn. Now, the smart money would be on learning from the mistakes of somebody else. And he said, son, there isn't anything that you're going to think of in your lifetime that I haven't already tested. I've already tried. So you come to me and you ask me, Dad, how is this going to work out when I do this? And I'll tell you. And then you can go out and experiment yourself and reinvent the wheel, or you can learn from my mistake when I invented the wheel. My old daddy was just about right. Just about right. Sometimes I never said a word to him, and I went out and he said, well, did you learn your lesson? I said, yep, I learned. And then he said, well, don't need to teach anymore. And then sometimes I'd go ask him, and then I wouldn't listen to him, and I'd do my own thing anyway. And sure enough, it would turn out bad for me. He said, well, did you learn anything from that, son? I said, yeah, Dad, I learned from that. I got that scope now. That's when you're 15, 20, 25, 30, and then you grow up about the time you're 40, 50, 60 years old, and you get to be an old folk like I am. You know, and the first thing you say to yourself, well, you know, maybe the old man wasn't as dumb as I'd give him credit for. And that's why the Bible says, go to the hoary head, you know, the old people with gray hair, and ask them. They'll tell you what's going on. They'll tell you how this is going to come down. Of course, most of you fellas have been to college, and there isn't anybody out there knows any more than you do. You know, once you get a college degree, you know it all. Just like the boys at Enron. See, the boys at Enron didn't understand how to connect the dots. WorldCom, same way. All these big corporations didn't understand what's going on here. The banks are taking over, and they're going to take over your expense. Now, I decided some years ago I didn't want to participate in the program, so I got out, got into gold and silver. I deal in property and property rights. I don't deal in commercial paper. I follow God's advice. Don't have an unjust weight or balance in your bag, so I don't. And I make credit cards, bank accounts, stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, mortgages, deeds of trust. I don't have any of it. Got rid of it. I used to. I don't want you to think I'm stupid, you know. I went to school. I had my credit cards. I used to have 28 of them. And I couldn't control my credit spending any better than anybody else can. I tested it. I had that experience. I used to run a corporation, employed 30 people, produced $1 million a year. I used to pay $10,000 a week my payroll. Yep, I know how to pay payroll taxes and make out income taxes and do all that kind of thing. I didn't make any money at it when I was in commercial business. And if you're not making any money at it, yeah, you're just about figuring out what I figured out 30 years ago. There's no money to be made in commercial business. The money is in sales and private business. And when I got out of commercial business and got into private business, then I started making money. And that's where the money's at. Now let's take a look at this inflatable currency. Why is it called inflatable currency? Well, it's because the only way new money goes into circulation in America under this system is when somebody borrows it from the banker. So when people are confident of success, they borrow much money, which increases the money supply, and all seem to prosper for a while. Then as they pay off their loans, the available money supply shrinks because the banks are getting it all back and it's not out in circulation anymore. Then we have recession and the money becomes scarce. And since they must always take more out of circulation than they put in because of the interest and other charges, then only other people borrowing still more money and spending it into circulation can keep a medium of exchange available to the nation to use for buying and selling. An example will aid our understanding here a little bit. So let's run this one by. If $40,000 is borrowed, then $126,432 must be paid back. So when a citizen goes to a banker to borrow $40,000 to purchase a home or a farm, the banker's clerk first queries the citizen to assign to the banker the right of ownership of the property of the borrower so that if he's unable to make his payments, the banker can foreclose and make a profit. The banker's clerk then gives the borrower a $40,000 check or he signs a $40,000 deposit slip crediting the borrower's checking account with a $40,000 deposit. There's no money involved here at all. We're just going to create $40,000 right out of thin air. The borrower, in turn, writes the necessary checks to the builder, seller, subcontractors, who in turn write checks, thereby putting $40,000 of checkbook money into circulation, but never leaves the bank. However, on a 30-year mortgage with 10% interest, the banker wants $331.20 a month paid to the bank, or a total of $126,432. So the buyer must take that $126,432 out of circulation, making the amount in circulation $86,432 less than when he purchased the home. Can you see how that works? So the banker has not produced anything of value except a slip of paper called a check or deposit slip. Yet he now has $86,432 more than he had before, minus a few hundred bucks of clerical and office costs. And the people as a whole have $86,432 less, because that money is going to have to be taken out of circulation. So you're going to have less money. That produces a recession, which means now we've got to reinflate. And that's the cycle. So when the recession occurred in 1989, because there was so much money being paid back and taken out of circulation, less money available to buy and sell with, make deals with, recession came along, so George Bush started inflating the currency. He did, but not fast enough. And then Clinton was elected, and through the 1990s, that accelerating inflated money, keep in mind that there was $3.5 trillion worth of money in circulation in 1987. By 2000, it increased to $9 trillion. So they went from 3 to 9. They put $6 trillion worth of new money out into the marketplace. God, it just made everybody happy, didn't it? And it made the stock market hit 11,500, and people were just jumping up and down the streets, weren't they? Well, then pretty soon, the balance was tipped, and then there's more money paying into the bankers with the interest that they got to be paying on all the things that they borrowed and bought during the 1990s recession. 2000 comes along. So now they're inflating from 9 to 13 trillion. They're going to put another $4 trillion out there, and that's what George Bush is doing right now. Can they pull the fat out of the fire one more time? God, I'm rooting for Bush. I hope he can do it. Well, the last thing in the world I want to see is a Great Depression like the 1930s. It's just that, you know, it's inevitable. One of these days, it's going to hit. One of these days, they're not going to be able to pull the fat out of the fire. Just like you, you know, you get real excited. You know somebody sends you a new credit card, and you say, wow, another $10,000 line of credit. Now I can keep everything afloat. I can use this $10,000 line of credit to keep paying on my credit cards and do all those things that I like to do, and I don't have to face reality for a while longer. You got five cards maxed out, that's $50,000. You got a mortgage. Fortunately, you got a job. You got a new line of credit for $10,000. You can keep things going for another year, two, or three, can't you? But you can see that, you know, at the end of a year, two, or three, unless somebody else sends you another $10,000 or $20,000 credit card 3 or 4 years from now, you know the end's the jig's up, ain't it? All right. Now, small loans are disastrous also, and we'll come to that in a minute here. I'm going to take a little break here and tell you another story. And we'll come back and take a look at small loans. Hey, you're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School. All of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, it was negotiated by Moses out of Mount Sinai. You and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. We're entitled to these things: rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Do you know that? You're entitled to all that. George Bush Sr. back in 1992 said that what Americans wanted, though, was jobs, 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 and that was echoed by George Bush Jr. in 2000. That's what they're telling us. Boy, we want jobs. You know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognize that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money's in sales. There is no money in public business, and there's no money in jobs, jobs, jobs. Now, it's time that you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the Old Covenant contract and to collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's called real property, instead of being paid in credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. And if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD Home School for Adults? That's my business school. And then order my free general law CD package, would you? You can do that at the same time. That's the first thing to do. Order that free general law CD package. It's free of charge. It doesn't cost you anything. Take you 5 minutes to make a phone call. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's free of charge. And you can call right now. The number's 417-273-4967. And if you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, here's what happens with small loans. For those who haven't quite grasped the impact of what we're discussing here, our national debt, here's what all of us owe. It isn't just to the federal government or to the Federal Reserve. It's what we all owe collectively as 300 million Americans. Now, let's consider a small auto loan for 3 years. Step one, Joe Sixpack borrows $3,000, and he pays it into circulation. He goes to a dealer, the factory, the miners, wherever it is, and he signs a note agreeing to pay back to the bankers $3,600. Step two, the citizen continues to work and pays $100 a month to the banker. In 36 months, he's taken $3,600 out of circulation and paid it to the bank, where it remains until someone else borrows it out again. So somebody has to keep borrowing that money and spending it into circulation. What's the net result? Well, $600 less money in circulation than before the loan was made. Because you see, when you go in to make the auto loan, they loan you $3,000. You go out and spend $3,000, but you got to pay $3,600 back. So you took $600 out of circulation that wasn't there. That's why you constantly have to reinflate the economy. That's why the federal government's never had a balanced budget for the last 50 or 60 or 70 years. There's back in the 50s, I think there was four or five balanced budgets. Maybe in the 60s there was one or two. I don't think there's been a balanced budget since about the Vietnam War. Clinton was talking about balancing the budget, but see, what they were doing there is they were taking $100 billion a year plus out of Social Security, paying their bills with that, putting an IOU into Social Security and calling that a balanced budget. That'd be about like you know, you're making 40 grand a year and so you're spending 50, so you borrow it out of your retirement money, and then you say, well, I balanced my budget. I made 40, spent 50, and I didn't acquire any new debt. I took $10,000 out of my retirement. Well, now you baby boomers, you know, that are going to start retiring in the year 2012. 2012 is where the Social Security Fund reaches its break-even point and starts losing money from that point on. So it's putting a surplus in there until 2012. And then from 2012 to 2032 of that 20-year period, they're going to pay it out and are going to go into debt $4 trillion. $3.8 trillion is the projected amount. There's some more debt. So there's no money in Social Security. It's being borrowed out and it's paid into the general fund and then paid out for ordinary business expenses, you know, like wars in Iraq and necessary items like that. Now, since money requires, as we have shown you, an increase with increased population and production, and paying off any loan decreases the available supply of money, it's obvious that we would quickly run out of money completely unless more and more people borrow more and more money to keep money in circulation. Now, there's a better way to do this. If we go back to gold and silver coin, what we would do is we would go out and dig it out of the ground. Now, let me run that story by you because it's kind of an interesting story. When I was a kid, my granddad told me that if you wanted to work, you could work for a dollar a day at the Union Lumber Company or work in the woods, 1900, when he was a boy. He was born in 1888. By 1900, he was 12 years old and he was out working in the woods, dollar a day. In fact, when he was 14, he was carrying railroad ties a quarter of a mile from the land out to ships on the wharf on the dock. He'd put one tie on his shoulder, walk a quarter of a mile, take it out there and load it on the ship and walk back and get another one and kept doing that all day long, got a dollar a day doing that. All right, now, if you didn't want to do that, you could go up on Wages Creek. The reason they called it Wages Creek is because if you was up there panning for gold on Wages Creek, which is up around Westport, it runs up and back Westport, you could get a dollar a day. You could make wages. Now, if a guy did that for 30 days, he'd have $30. He could take that $30 worth of gold down to San Francisco, hand it over to the mint, pay him 1% of that, and they would give him a 20 and a $10 gold piece. Isn't that just special? Now he's got a 20 and a 10. His 30 days of labor is what puts that $30 into circulation. Work is what's behind it, just weights and balances. Labor is the backing for it. It isn't created right out of thin air. And that's why that's called a production economy. See, we went from a production to a consumption economy. Now, people really don't like to work. People don't like to produce. Now, if you didn't want to work, you know, pan and gold out there, you could go work in the lumber mill. So, you know, you go down to the lumber mill, and you work in the mill, and they would pay you $30 a month to work in the lumber mill. Now, if they produced too many boards, then they couldn't get as much for them, so they'd cut you back, and they'd say, well, we're only going to pay you 90 cents a day now. Well, you know, a bunch of guys would get ticked off. If you're only going to pay me 90 cents a day, I can go make a dollar a day panning for gold. So a bunch of them would leave the mill and go pan for gold. Now, we've got an increase in gold production, don't we? And now we've got a decrease in board production. Now there's a shortage of boards. Now all of a sudden there's a shortage of boards, and the lumber mill says, well, we'll pay you $1.10 a day. Well, the guys can only make a dollar a day panning for gold, so they say, well, I'm going back to work in the mill. And this is called supply and demand. And supply and demand is the natural forces that God has set in motion to keep your economy stable. There's a couple other little things like a land Sabbath, Jubilee, in the year that comes along, redemption. You know, there's the redemption of the firstborn things. There's some other economic laws that fit in here. But the basic law is thou shalt not steal and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. And the system worked so well that between 1787 and 1950, America became the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world. We, 13 backward colonies, today we would call them 13 third world nations, banded together in a federal union. And in about 150 years, we became the world's number one producer of steel, number one producer of automobiles, telephones, coal, aluminum, airplanes, automobiles. Today, that's being shifted over to China. We've lost our preemption, our preeminence, I should say, our preeminence. We used to be number one in all 15 leading economic indicators of industrial production in 1950. Today, we're not number one in any of the 15 leading economic indicators of industrial production. Not one. That's a pretty dramatic change, wouldn't you say? From 1950 to 2000, 50 years or so, you know, we've been on the slippery slope sliding downhill. And the people that are in control are not going back to gold and silver, and they're not going back to property. They're not going back to thou shalt not steal, just weights and balances. They're going to continue on with fiat paper money, more inflation, and more theft. And they want you to do the same thing. And if you follow along after that crowd, poverty will be your reward. It's always been that way in the past. No reason to believe that it isn't going to be that way again in the future. So these small loans then, when you put these millions of little loans along with those mortgage loans out there, they all work to make us consumers instead of producers. And the ultimate end is we have a boom and bust cycle. Boom and bust, boom and bust, boom and bust. There's nothing stable about our monetary system. Now, if you multiply the above examples by hundreds of millions of times in the last half century, you can see why in that time, America has gone from being a prosperous, debt-free nation to a debt-ridden nation, where practically every home, every farm, every business is mortgaged to the bankers, and their cars, furniture, and clothes are purchased with borrowed money. The interest of the bankers on personal, local, state, and federal debt totals more than the combined earnings of the 25% of the working population. And the cost of them, practically nothing. You see, in the tens of millions of transactions made each year, like those above, little actual money actually changes hands, nor is it necessary that it do so. 95% of all the cash transactions in the United States are done by check now. So the banker is perfectly safe in creating that so-called loan by writing the check or the deposit slip, not against actual money, but against your promise to pay it back. The only cost to him is the paper, ink, and a few dollars in salaries and office costs for each transaction. It's a check-kiting scheme on an immense scale, and the profits are enormous. Enormous. In fact, Valley Bank, here's a couple of headlines here. Valley Bank posts 49% gain in profits. Bank's profit rises 21%. First National Bank reports 30% gain. Banks aren't building these big skyscrapers, you know, like the Sears Tower and the World Trade Towers and the Bank of America building in San Francisco. They don't build that, you know, off of making a spread of 4%. You know, people think, well, I loaned the banker. I deposited $1,000 in the bank, and they pay me 6% interest and loan it out for 10. Well, they couldn't pay the light bill with 4%. First of all, the bank makes $1,000 by creating the loan, then they make the interest on the loan. The interest on the loan pays the overhead, and the profit comes from you paying the loan back. Yeah, that's a hell of a neat deal. It's the second most profitable business ever devised by the mind of God or man. You see, banking has, you know, a tremendous, it's 100, 200, 300, 400, 500% return. The most profitable business ever created by the mind of God is 87,200%, and that comes from farming. And farmers are going broke, and their farms have been taken away from them, and we've seen foreclosures in agriculture. You know, we used to have about 50% of our people living on the land in 1900, 42%, I believe it was, by 1920. Today it's down to 200,000 nationwide. It's less than 200,000. We have more people locked up in prison than we have farming. Yeah, more people locked up in prison than we have farming. And that's because all the farmers have been driven off the land. Only a farmer could take a 87,200% profit margin and screw it up and go broke. And the only way you can do that is to go into business with the banks and borrow money and pay interest and usury. Now, if you do that, you can go broke. Now, if you play this game the way God designed it, you know, 87,200%, you know, is a little better than banking, twice as good as insurance. It's almost as good as being a politician. Now, the cost to you is practically everything. See, in 1910, the United States federal debt was only $1,146,000,000. That's $12.40 per citizen. State and local debts were practically non-existent, and government was small, and it was not oppressive. By 1920, after only 6 years of Federal Reserve shenanigans, the federal debt had jumped to $24 billion. That's $228.23 per person, and government begins to grow. By 1968, the federal debt was $347 billion. That was $1,700 per citizen. And in only 10 more years, 1978, it doubled to $763 billion, or about $3,491 per citizen. Today, the debt is $20,000 per person in the United States. $20,000 per person. Now, the above numbers don't indicate or include state, municipal, school, district, business, or personal debts, which total an additional $60,000 for every working family, or approximately $5 trillion as of 1978, when this publication was put out. Today, if you took that $60,000 per working family, 20/40/60, you know, that means that you got $80,000 per head that you owe right now, on average. Everybody in America owes $80,000. Now, you're a surety underwriter for a bunch more. You know, these veterans coming back from the Gulf War, you know, they're entitled to a lot of benefits. And every one of these guys that's injured over there, you know, there's been several thousand injured. Those guys have to be taken care of for the rest of their life. Productive citizens are no longer productive. They become welfare recipients. And I'm not saying they don't deserve it. They shouldn't get it. I'm just pointing out that you'd be better off if you left those boys at home working and producing than you would to send them over there and get their legs blown off and make them wards of the state for the rest of their lives. There's enough wards of the state out there. We don't need to create any more. Now, if you take a look at the gamblers among the people of America, to grasp the truth that periodic withdrawal of money through interest payments will inexorably transfer all of the wealth in the nation to the receiver of the interest, just imagine yourself in a poker game or a dice game, where everyone must buy the chips. The medium of exchange is the chips. Now, we're going to buy into this game. We got to buy these chips from the banker, who does not risk chips in the game. All he does is watches the table, and every hour he reaches in and takes 10% of all the chips on the table. So as the game goes on, the amount of chips in the possession of each player will go up and down with his luck. However, the total number of chips available to play the game or carry on trade and business will decrease as the game progresses along. The game will get low on chips, and some of the players will run out. And if they want to continue to play, then they must buy or borrow them from the banker. The banker will sell lend them only if the player signs a mortgage agreeing to give the banker some real property, car, home, farm, business, or something. And if he cannot make periodic payments to pay back all of the chips plus some extra ones for interest, the payments must be made on time, whether he wins, that is, makes a profit or not. I don't know if you've ever played a game down at the card room, you know, but they used to take a dollar every 15 minutes, cost you $4 an hour to sit in a poker game. So I'd go down to the rich, you know, buy into a game. Maybe I've got $100, you know, when I was a youngster, I used to do that. So I'm sitting there playing low ball at the Ritz, and I got $100 worth of chips in front of me. And every 15 minutes, the croupier comes along, the houseman, they call, and he takes one of my chips. He takes one chip from every player around the table. Now, let's suppose there's five players in the game, and five players all have $100, it's $500. So everybody is playing $4, that's $20 an hour. By the time we've played for 10 hours, at $20 an hour, that's $200. Now, we had $500 on the table when we started the game. Now, there's only $300 on the table. And if you need more chips, then you've got to reach in your wallet and pull out your checkbook or pull out some cash and buy some more chips to stay in the game. That's one of the best examples I think I've ever seen anybody use for explaining how our money system works. The house never loses, and we've bought into this game, and I don't see any reason to sit here and play this game. Why don't the five of us just go over to my garage? We'll buy in for the same $500, and we'll sit here and play free. And then we'll go over to Tom's garage. That's the way we used to play cards. When I was a kid, we'd go over to Black's place. Then we'd go over to Leo's. Then we'd go over to John's. Come over to my place. Go over to Rich Michael's. You know, we just move around, and we brought the same amount of money, gambled the same amount of time, had the same amount of fun, did everything that we wanted to do. There isn't any reason here in the United States of America for us to borrow money from the Federal Reserve to circulate money. The federal government can do it. In fact, the Congress authorizes, the Constitution authorizes Congress to do just that, and they ought to, but they don't. In fact, our founding fathers thought they'd banished paper money, banished this shill game. Back with Article 1, Section 10, says no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. But hey, listen, once the bankers get in here to bribing your politicians, they'll enact whatever laws they want. The people of America have lost the government. It's out of control. You can't control that. You can't control Enron, ADM, and the ethanol, you know, the ethanol deal. You haven't got any input into that. You're not going to stop that. I suggest that you think about withdrawing from the game. Take a look at 1 Samuel chapter 8. Read that and then say, well, do you think that was one of your better moves? If you do, stick with George Bush and company. If you don't, why don't you make a shift over to Moses? I think Moses and that gang has a better program and a better system than does the Federal Reserve, the Republicans, and the Democrats. That's worth looking at. I tried it. I've been doing it for 20 years or more, and I think it's the greatest thing since sliced white bread. No income tax, no Social Security. Of course, I don't collect anything on Social Security. You know, I'm old enough to collect, but I don't. Why would I want to collect $800 a month? Chicken feed. Who wants to waste time screwing around on $800 a month? Let's go out here and make some money. Let's go out here and do something intelligent. You know, I used to run a business to make $100,000 a year. Why would I want to screw around with $800 a month on Social Security? Why don't you go out here and work? Get out of taxes. Very simple. The tax is on income. There's no law that requires you to have income. You've been persuaded that you cannot live without income. My God, Americans were living quite nicely on property without any income in 1900 before we had an income tax. Somebody comes along and says, well, gosh, you got to have this paper money, credit cards, and checks. You got to have income. Well, okay. If you want to work for WorldCom and Enron and the government and be an employee, non-employee is just a polite term. It's a politically correct term for bond servant. Bond servants used to have a hole drilled in their right ear and an earring stuck in there. I see people running around today with earrings in their ears. I was watching 60 Minutes the other day, and Ed Bradley's got an earring in his ear. I don't know if he's a queer or if he's got a bond servant contract with CBS. You can check my ears. There are no holes in George Gordon's ears. Used to be if a man had a hole in his ear, we'd look at you and say, God, what happened to you? Tell me your sad tale of woe, how you went broke and then you went into bond servitude for 15 or 20 years, which is the equivalent of going to prison. See, we lock people up in prison today. See, in the old days, you didn't lock people up in prison. They're non-productive in there. It cost $3,000 to $5,000 a year to store somebody in prison. We weren't dumb in the old days. We put those people to work. We sold them to somebody and made them work, produce. That's when we had a production economy instead of a consumption economy. See, a consumption economy can only last until you've consumed all of your assets. You know, if you want to test it, why don't you? Just take everything that you've got right now and add it up on your balance sheet. And let's say you got $500,000. You know, just say you got $500,000. Now, you're earning $50,000, and you're spending $40,000, and you're adding $10,000 to your net estate every year. And let's assume you're free and clear. You're not, but let's assume that you are. Now, you have $500,000, you're adding to it at the rate of $10,000 a year. My God, every Every 10 years, you're adding another $100,000 to your estate, aren't you? All right. Now we can do it the other way. You are making $50,000. Let's spend $60,000. Well, how long is that going to last? Well, let's see. You take 50, or no, take 500, and divide that by 10. And in 50 years, you'll be broke. You'll consume all of your assets in 50 years. And that's what Americans have been doing over the last 7 years. We have now consumed all of our assets. Our debts now exceed the entire value of all of the land and buildings and all of the chattels contained in the United States of America. If we sold everything we've got at market value, which you'd never get, but you know, assuming you could not pay your debts. And we're getting close to the point where we can't even service the interest on the debt. Now, you know, this game gets low on chips, and it's easy to see that no matter how skillful the play, eventually the banker will end up with all the original chips back, and except for the very best players, the rest, if they stay in long enough, will lose to the banker their homes, their farms, their businesses, and perhaps even their cars, watches, rings, and the shirts off their backs. And that's where we're headed. Ford Motor Company is in financial trouble. Many big corporations, you know, like Xerox and some of these big old-timey companies have been around for a long time, they're in financial trouble, and they'll be going the way of Enron. Just give them a little more time. And that's because there's a limit to how long you can stay in the game. And all business at some point in time ends. Business, all of them ends. You know, like the Studebaker Company? You know, they were around for over 100 years. Studebaker. And they're not around anymore. Packard, Hudson, you know, big corporations that used to be around, and we bought and sold their stocks and one thing and another, and we thought, well, boy, these are big blue-chip companies, aren't they? Gone now. And all business ends either by bankruptcy, merger, or going out of business sale. One of those three. And that's what's happened to all these big corporations. And all these big corporations that are around right now that you've got a job with, they're outsourcing your job to India. They don't really care about you. They care about the bottom line. And if they can hire a guy in India for $5 a day and they're paying you $50 or $100 a day, your job's gone. If there's any way that they can move that job, they're going to move it. Yeah, I'm about out of time. We'll have to break off right about here, and we'll come back and we'll take up the subject of the national debt tomorrow night. Same time, same station right here on KU Band Radio or on the Internet, wherever you're listening. You've been listening to The Law Hour. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour has been brought to you by the Gordon Law School as an educational service in the public interest. Now, for more information about The Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. Now, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call direct 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is brought to you by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information on the Gordon Law School, remember, go to the Law Hour, or the Law Hour. Just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Keep in mind that the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Well, we're just about out of time. We'll have to leave it right here. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.